So those are some of the major ideas that inform that thing that we are calling postmodernism. But that raises the question, how and why did these marginally related ideas become a separate movement? And the answer is, they didn't. Or more to the point, there is no single movement that can be called postmodernism. Sure, plenty of people will do their level best to provide some unified field theory of POMO that attempts to encompass every possible permutation. But in fact, one of the distinguishing characteristics of postmodernism is its lack of pure distinguishing characteristics. Unlike, say, Gothic architecture, where you can provide a list of attributes and anything that has those attributes is Gothic and anything that doesn't isn't, postmodernism can be very elusive. Of course, there are clear-cut examples, and we'll talk about some of them, but there are plenty of less clear-cut examples. For instance, I've seen Philip Johnson's Glass House, famous Glass House, referred to as capital M modern, and then again as capital P postmodern in reputable publications from knowledgeable critics. Well, folks, it can't be both. So which is it? As I say, we are going to stick to easy examples. Which brings us back to the issue of artists. Throughout Caveman, we've been using art and artists as touch points, as examples of what we're talking about. Also, we've discussed artists as synthesizers of the ideas of their times. No work of art exists in some cultural vacuum. A painter in the Renaissance was affected by the ideas floating around in the times, regardless of whether those ideas referred directly to art. Painters listened to music, writers wondered about politics. Everybody is a citizen of their times. The same is true of the postmodern period, which perhaps more than any we've discussed so far is defined by art. The artist who keeps an ear to the ground, the artist who thinks, the artist who tries to make a statement has, one way or another, been exposed to the ideas we've been talking about in this section. The artist has heard about semiotics, about signs and metaphors, about the meaning of language and the working of the brain. The artist has thought about structuralism, boiling works of art down to their process with no interest in result. The artist has heard about deconstruction and the exclusion of minority voices. The artist has learned that the powerful decide right and wrong. The artist has seen how reality has become unreality, how real life has become a theme park. The artist has done or thought all of these things, or some of these things. The artist may have read original sources or may have picked it up on the streets. The artist may understand Foucault or Baudrillard or Derrida, or has come up with a unique bastardized version that blends them in one intellectual bouillabaisse. It doesn't matter, because, right or wrong, these are the ideas of the time. And with all of these ideas in that artistic little head, the artist acts. The artist creates art. But that is neither here nor there at the moment. The biggest abettor of the POMO artist is the POMO critic, literally. There is thought that some postmodern art cannot exist without critics to explain it. In modernism, art was what artists said was art. In postmodernism, art is what critics say is art. There's a big difference between the two. And however you slice it, you know that the end result is not a painting you can walk up to and look at and say, gee, that's very pretty. I'd like to hang that in my living room. Except, of course, in those cases of ironic postmodernism, but we'll just be taking this subject so far in this lecture. So with postmodernism in mind, let's look at the arts one more time, after which we'll look at some specific areas of debate material. You knew that we were going to get there eventually. Now, you might say that art in the postmodern age draws no distinction between itself and reality. How do you tell the difference? How do you tell the difference between art and reality? After all, much of our reality, according to Baudrillard at least, is an attempt to recreate the unreality of the so-called Disney-esque. Or if you're a semiotician, you know that there can be no reality, only individual perceptions of sensory data. Some artists become extremely political, usually in aid of a single disempowered group. Some artists use the reality-unreality thing to inject irony into their work. Irony is a key concept of postmodern art. Maybe it's just another word for self-consciousness, but it is also consciousness of the structures in which the artist is working. Some artists no longer separate themselves from their art. For example, performance artists. In the postmodern, among other things, it's about the narrator. Let's start with gallery art, so-called. How do you account for a pile of dirt on the floor? A pile of dirt on the floor of the gallery. At the Pompidou Center in Paris, there is a room with a pile of dirt on the floor. A real room in a real museum with a pile of dirt on the floor. There is a little card naming this work of art and providing the identity of the artist who piled that dirt there. How, in the name of all that is holy, is this a work of art? Or is the person who dumped this dirt on the floor an artist? For that matter, did the artist actually even do the dumping? Or did he hire some day laborers? Well, the art itself isn't going to tell you the answers. The artist won't tell you. But the fact that this pile of real dirt is in a real museum tells you that it must be a real work of art, or otherwise it wouldn't be there. But it's obviously not a work of art that requires artistic skill. It does require critical skill, however, either on the part of the artist or the museum curator or someone who has convinced the necessary people that, yes, this pile of dirt is a work of art. And that's where the critics come in. They'll be happy to tell you why this is a work of art. Talk to them. Don't talk to me. I happen to like paintings of pretty landscapes. I think a pile of dirt is a pile of dirt. Hanging a naked human being on the wall is art. Machines that destroy themselves are art. A pile of bricks is art. There's an example in Butler's Postmodernism, which I mention on my blog page, of a gallery display that consisted of nothing more than a sign saying that there is no gallery display. This, too, is art. How do these things qualify? All of them reflect irony, consciousness of structures, a blurring of the line between art and reality. They question the very meaning of art. They challenge the meaning of art. Perhaps they reject the meaning of art. Are they art? Is art what artists say is art? Or are these only art because critics say that they are art? Draw your own conclusions. And go back a bit to modernism. Go back to the time when artists learned abstraction, when artists acquired the freedom to express themselves outside the boundaries of classicism, when paint was about paint and color was about color and perspective was about perspective. Where does the thinking artist go from there? Those statements have already been made. What statement does today's artist have to make? And here's the chief difference in art between modernism and postmodernism. Georgia O'Keeffe, a quintessential modernist, painted flowers, among other things. They may or may not look to you like flowers, but as she said, They are flowers the way she feels them. She was painting to express her inner self. The result is an abstraction of flowers. That is modernism to the core. It's individualism to the core. By comparison, the postmodern artist makes an intellectual statement of some sort where the feelings of the artist and the structural issues of art, for example, color or perspective, are coincidental, if involved at all. The postmodern artist, often in collusion with critics, comments on what art is or ought to be, often by doing nothing we would normally think of as artistic. They've gone beyond structure. They've gone beyond modernism and the individual. So in a way, you can see where that pile of dirt came from. Marcel Duchamp took a urinal and said it was art because he, as an artist, determined what it was that got to be the thing called art. It's a short step from this inceptive declaration to the Pompidou's pile of dirt. Okay, let's turn to books. Literature, like all areas of art, must deal with the concept of what happens after modernism. What happens after we have allowed unbridled personal expression to the point of incomprehensibility? That is James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which we've already talked about. One result of going around expressing your individuality every 2 seconds is a fairly full sense of self. You could say that the journey into the self is infinite, and perhaps it is, but honestly, it probably can't support infinite canvases, especially infinite written canvases. Once we went as far as we can go individually and wrote about it, we found out a couple of things. We found out most of what there was to find out about ourselves, and we learned that, in general, books about that were pretty boring. Think about it. Of all the art areas we've been talking about as we've adhered to the concept of narrative, literature is obviously the most directly narrative. Literature specifically sets out to tell a story, usually. Storytelling is not its only goal, but it is its substance. Literature that does not tell stories is whatever you want to call it, but pretty obviously it's not basic storytelling. And if literature is, substantively and purposefully, storytelling, then sooner or later experiments in non-narrative literature are going to peter out. And historically, they did. As with everything we're talking about, plenty of writers never paid much attention to modernism, and therefore today don't pay much attention to postmodernism. But those writers who are intrigued by the ideas of the POMOs have done some interesting work. In literature that is deliberately postmodern, the defining aspect may be the irony of the material. The irony. POMO lit is self-conscious in a way that non-POMO isn't. POMO writers have gone back to storytelling, but that storytelling is informed with the self-conscious knowledge of the past and of the structures of storytelling itself. So you see a lot of archetypal genre work in pastiches, for example. If someone writes a mystery story, instead of calling it The Case of the Missing Bride, they call it Mystery Story. Elements in the story are reduced to their essences, and we often see and feel the author winking at us. One nice result of postmodern thinking is the acceptance of minorities as important literary voices, although the material itself may or not be postmodern. For that matter, minorities are not only accepted, but sought after in music and painting and all areas of art. This empowerment of the formerly disempowered has come about for a variety of reasons, but one of them certainly is as an end result of activism originated in deconstruction. Not that POMO has ended racism by any means or ended any ism, but at least in some intellectual circles, some eyes have been opened. And that has to be seen as a good thing. There is a variety of reading you could do if you wanted to explore postmodern literature, and I'm going to make 3 recommendations. First, there's Alain Robbe-Grillet. Robbe-Grillet. Robe Grillet. Conveniently, French. Robe Grillet is identified with the Nouvelle Roman, the new novel. A book called Project for a Revolution in New York is a perfectly good start. Much of the action is a subway train riding through the tunnels of the city. Robe Grillet's style is the key to his content. Project for a Revolution in New York. Second, there is Umberto Eco, an Italian semiotician who wrote, among other things, The Name of the Rose. He's pretty famous. Eco's content deals with narrative and identity. Okay, the book The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. That's the one I'm recommending. Now, in The Mysterious Flame, a man wakes up remembering all the books he has read, but nothing of himself. In the way we might describe it, he seems to have all the dots in his brain, but no connection for them. This is pretty interesting reading. Third, and I'll describe this one in a little detail, is Paul Auster's, A-U-S-T-E-R, Paul Auster's City of Glass. As far as postmodernism is concerned in literature, Auster is, capital I, it. City of Glass is the perfect example of POMO because it is completely invested in discussing identity and meaning. The hero, named Quinn, is a writer who writes under a pseudonym and who identifies most with the hero of the pulpy mystery novels that he himself writes pseudonymously. His own life and his pseudonym's life seem empty. One night he gets a phone call, a wrong number, asking to speak to the detective, whose name is Paul Auster. Eventually, Quinn claims to be Auster. So question number one is, who is the narrator here? Quinn goes on the case and learns about a wild child situation, which explores the nature of language. There is the concept of the correct name of things. A wild child, by the way, is a child who was just raised in the wilderness with no contact with human beings. So anyhow, as I said, this is about the correct name of things. For example, an umbrella is an item composed of top and spokes that keeps you dry. What do you call it when its function is no longer served? The biblical Adam gave all things their correct names. After the fall, we only have made-up names. All of this obviously connects to the concepts of semiotics. Now, there's plenty more to Auster's story. And if you want to explore the linguistic and identity issues of POMO, I know of absolutely no better starting point. Now, of course, we've been talking a lot about architecture up to now because architecture is an interesting subject that usually gets overlooked in high school discussions of art. But architecture is big because buildings are big. The meaning of buildings, of living space and public space, are every bit as important to our lives as the art that inhabits those spaces. It's been a bit indulgent of me, perhaps, but there are some illustrative aspects to architecture that do make the subject of modernism and postmodernism clearer. As in many areas, often modernism and postmodernism are confused by architectural critics, and one building will be called one by one critic and another by the other critic. I already mentioned Johnson's famous glass house, and that doesn't help us much. But there are some key ideas in the postmodern that are good to know. In modernism, the great big glass and steel construction, devoid of decoration, was an enormous breakthrough in building. The steel that can raise a building to record-breaking heights didn't exist when the Romans were going about building arches and domes. The mechanics of building changed completely when materials became available that were strong enough to shape a building any way you wanted it shaped. Now, the modernists were able to build big, tall buildings without having to support them with arches and buttresses and columns and thick walls. Thanks to modern steel, the stresses of the materials will keep the building from falling down. The Romans couldn't have built anything as tall as, say, the UN, because the physics are impossible if you don't have the steel and concrete. Modern steel allows the modern physics. The modernist building may be the simplest, easy-to-understand piece of modernism if you limit your discussion to buildings like the UN, or the Seagram's Building, or any glass and steel box. These buildings reach for the sky in a faceless, futuristic, shiny way devoid of decoration. Their open spaces are clean and spare. They speak intimately of their time and place. And they have the personality of an empty tomb. Architecture has some unique aspects that differentiate it from other art forms. All architecture is public, and much architecture is wildly expensive. It is enduring, lasting not only years or decades, but possibly even centuries. And it permeates our lives. I can avoid music or books or paintings, but I work in a building and I live in a building, catch a train from a building, get tried for murder in a building, make laws in a building, etc., etc., etc. Certain buildings carry enormous metaphoric, maybe symbolism, in their cultures. These unique aspects of architecture make architects into some of our most conscious artists. By the same idea that you can't successfully build a skyscraper from mud, you can't get buildings built that don't fit into their place and time. No one will give you the money if your ideas don't appeal to them. So, more than any other artist, architects are beholden to their audiences before they even create their works. It's a strange situation. And your major architects, as a result, are some of your most interesting thinkers. And like any thinkers, they absorb the ideas of their times, and in our case now, the postmodern times. One last thing before looking at some examples. Thanks to further developments in building materials and techniques like computer modeling, architects are now able to do things that were unthinkable even 50 years ago at the height of modernism. To some extent, at least visually, the laws of physics no longer apply. Or maybe, put better, architecture is subject to different laws. Given that the laws of physics are the paint and easel of the architect, you can start to understand what that means. The easiest, most familiar example to us may be the modern roller coaster. Till recently, you had nothing but wood and nothing but pure gravity moving cars over tracks, rolling and coasting. There is absolutely no difference between the very first wooden roller coaster and a wooden roller coaster built this year. Compare steel roller coasters. Inversions, loops, four dimensions, you start to get the picture. And by the way, wooden roller coasters that have inversions, loops, and four dimensions aren't entirely made of wood. A man named Frank Gehry, G-E-H-R-Y, is emblematic of modern architecture. Probably the most famous architect alive, for that matter. Much of his work can be seen as a response to the stripped-down modernist approach. Thanks to computer modeling and new materials, he's able to build buildings that have massive metal roofs that emulate clouds or waves. And take a look at the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao in Spain. He no longer needs to worry about holding up his roof, so his roofs bear no resemblance to the roofs of the past. Domes, schmomes. He builds buildings that twist and twirl around each other with no straight lines. Check out another Gehry building, or pair of buildings, I guess, Fred and Ginger in Prague. These are exercises in form irrespective of function. Doing what he can because he can. Exhilarating in freedom from the old prescriptions of materials and physics. He's attempting to answer the question, if buildings can be anything at all, what should they be? And parenthetically, I don't want to imply that his buildings are not functional. From what I've seen of Bilbao, and I haven't been there, it looks like a fantastically accessible art museum. And I know, having seen exhibits of his work, that he is very, very involved in acoustics. He builds a lot of music halls, including the Disney Music Hall in Los Angeles, and really thinks about function there. You can't just build it anyway because the sound will get all and go everywhere. So you have to concentrate in. So I don't want you to think he is separating form from function, but certainly the physics, the materials allow the look of a building to do anything but represent its function. Another man named Rem Koolhaas, K-O-O-L HAS, and by the way, one of his books is also recommended on the blog, is a visionary architect attempting to answer the same question. Search Cool House out yourself to see what I mean. But to give one example, think about skyscrapers. Skyscrapers are very much apotheosized by the modernists, when you can build pretty much as high as you want with tempered steel, and you end up creating entire avenues in New York consisting of one glass building after the other, or one glass tombstone. And what we're talking about here is around 6th Avenue in the 40s and 50s. It is curious that the modernist expression of self, as we've described it in other areas, often comes up with an anti-humanist faceless shape in architecture. Certainly, Frank Lloyd Wright's Guggenheim building in New York is modernist and anything but anti-humanist, but the trend that took hold and that provided a blueprint, theoretically, for other work in the modernist world was the glass box, because it was ultimately cheap and not particularly hard to design, so you didn't need to hire a Wright or a Gehry to build it. Any schlub would do. Hence, 6th Avenue from 42nd Street to 57th Street. And by the way, I knew 6th Avenue before it looked like that. I actually worked around there when I was a teenager. It was about halfway coming. So there were a lot of still ground-level delis and crappy places and whatever that you really didn't want to hang around, and all of them are destroyed now. You walk up that stretch of 6th Avenue, one tombstone after the other. If anything can easily define Rem Koolhaas, it's one of his unbuilt designs for a skyscraper. I emphasize unbuilt. A skyscraper at its best reaches up for the sky, as tall as can be, stretching the grasp of humankind. Taiwan 1, the World Trade Center, the Sears Building, these buildings speak of our grasp of the infinite. Hey, allow me a little poetry, right? By contrast, Koolhaas's skyscraper, the one that wasn't built, is in the shape of a U, upside down. His skyscraper reaches for the sky, gets halfway there, changes its mind, and comes down again. It is the perfect response to the overreaching mind that simply wants its building to be taller than every other building, to make the rather dull statement, or at least it's dull nowadays, that I'm the biggest gun on the street. I've got the tallest building. When you attempt to build the world's tallest building, you're making a civic statement, which inevitably seems to be confined to emerging economies of one sort or another. When your skyscraper doesn't bother anymore, the irony and self-consciousness is perfect. I love it. Baudrillard talked about the taking of real life and turning it into a theme park. First inside the gates of an actual theme park, and then spilling over outside the gates to the point where the attempts to recreate reality were informing reality itself. Postmodernist architecture can also do this, in spades, because the freedom from the restraints of materials can be taken so far as to be freedom from the restraints of reality. Hence, two buildings of postmodernist theme architecture, high end and low end, that I want to talk about. At the high end, the Team Disney building. Look it up on the internet, the Team Disney building. There are 7 columns. They are designed as literally the 7 dwarfs. This is a highly respected building, applauded as a great example of postmodernism. At the low end, and this is just one example, there is now a clothing franchise in malls where each store has a tropical porch entrance. I mean literally a porch with a little roof. This is the essence of POMO. Obviously, you don't need a roof on a storefront that's indoors. And secondly, the use of the tropical theme is to create a special unreality in aid of commerce that is, in Baudrillardian terms, the end of life on the planet. Commerce as a negative force is certainly an aspect Baudrillard examines in his work, although we didn't talk about it much. In these examples, we see one of the other touchstones of postmodern architecture, the capturing of ideas from other places. Sampling. If you wanted to understand what postmodernism is in architecture, or at least how to recognize it, look for the sampling. using pyramids or domes or Native American designs or, well, you name it, to set a theme that is separate from the place itself. And to see this on the grandest scale, buy yourself a ticket to Las Vegas. So, is there any summary of all this? Well, probably not. Art in the world today is so complex and varied that it is probably an idiot's task to even think about summing it up. But we can say that, in some cases, as a response to the modern, artists have returned to narrative, but with a new understanding of what they're doing. In other cases, they throw away narrative completely and even go beyond narration into, well, for example, the pile of dirt.